This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 26th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, the lead article is entitled, Gray, Drug Market Preys on Hospitals Here, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. Drug shortages continue to plague hospitals, forcing some to turn to a very expensive and shady supply chain called the gray market for much-needed and sometimes life-saving pharmaceuticals. The Institute for Safe Medication Practices surveyed 549 hospitals nationwide and found that 56% are solicited daily by a gray market vendor, and another 28% receive weekly solicitations. Separately, Premier Incorporated, a national alliance of hospitals and other providers, recorded 1,745 gray market offers to providers with an average markup and price of 650% over the same drug in the established supply chain. Rex Healthcare, for example, had to buy some doses of concentrated electrolyte potassium phosphate from the gray market, says Rex Director of Pharmacy Jane Green, who says the hospital pays markups ranging from double to sixfold for such purchases. Drug shortages are at a record high in this country, with 180 documented in the first 6 months of 2011, according to the University of Utah Drug Information Service. In the second half of 2010, Premier recorded 240 drugs in short supply or unavailable and more than 400 generic varieties that were backordered for 5 or more days. The cost to the healthcare systems is immense, says WakeMed Health and Hospitals Director of Pharmacy Lynn Eschenbacher. The American Society of Health System Pharmacists estimated the cost nationally at $216 million a year in terms of markups. Gray market vendors exacerbate the problem by capitalizing on the desperation of pharmacy directors and buyers, according to the ISMP. These vendors have been unrelenting in their quest to make huge profits by supplying hospitals with life-saving medications that are otherwise unavailable. WakeMed has not gone to the gray market, says Eschenbacher, but still pays more because of low supplies. The hospital typically buys prefilled epinephrine cartridges, syringes, for $1.92. Because of a shortage, it recently paid $15 per syringe. We wanted to make sure that if someone's heart stopped, that the drug would be immediately available, she says. The same is true at Rex, says Green, who stressed that even when the hospital goes to the gray market, it makes sure the drugs are safe and effective. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration requires each pharmaceutical manufacturer to file a drug pedigree defined as a statement of origin that identifies each prior sale, purchase, or trade of a drug, including the date of those transactions and the names and addresses of all parties to them. Before it will consider a gray market drug, Rex requires that pedigree and will not buy a drug if it has changed hands too many times. We try not to, Green says, but when we are forced to purchase off the gray market, we insist on having that pedigree in hand. Nationwide, 74% of hospitals have concerns about authenticity of drugs from the gray market, and 58% have concerns about storage conditions, according to the ISMP survey. The background of these gray market vendors and how they get the medications they sell remains largely a mystery. Premier recorded 18 such vendors, but did not identify any by name. Kuldip Patel, Duke University Hospital Associate Chief Pharmacy Officer, says solicitations come in the form of emails or faxes with little or no identifying information. Typically, the vendors want to communicate through an 800 number or vague email account, he says. Much of that clearly is due to how illegitimate the whole business model is, he says, adding that Duke has not purchased drugs from gray market vendors. For their part, drug manufacturers and authorized distributors say they have nothing to do with the gray market. John Parker, a spokesman for the Healthcare Distribution Management Association, says his group's members do not participate in the gray market, nor do we condone price gouging. He did speculate about how gray market vendors get drugs. In the ISMP survey, some wholesale vendors some wholesalers admitted to selling to gray market vendors. GlaxoSmithKline requires its wholesalers to purchase products only from GSK, according to Jennifer Armstrong, a spokeswoman for Glaxo. Furthermore, we strongly discourage pharmacies and hospitals from buying GSK products from any supplier except one of our authorized wholesalers. Congress is considering a bill that would require drug manufacturers to alert the FDA 6 months in advance of planned discontinuance or interruption of drug production and require the FDA to clearly publish that data on its website. We believe this is a critical step in the process, says Joseph Hill, the Director for Federal and Legislative Affairs with the ASHP. He did not know of any legislation to go after gray market vendors, but said it would be something we look at very carefully. For our members, it's a real problem, he said. It's adding insult to injury. Continuing on the front page, legal discovery arrives in E-Age in New North Carolina Law by Chris Bagley from Raleigh. New procedures in obtaining electronic documents in litigation go into effect October 1st in North Carolina, a change that could speed up civil cases and save money for plaintiffs and defendants related to the discovery process. Passed by both houses of the legislature unanimously and signed into law in June, House Bill 380 was modeled loosely on rules that went into effect in federal courts in 2006. 2 decades after email became common in the business world, North Carolina had no state laws regulating so-called e-discovery. State judges have typically looked to federal standards when telling a plaintiff and defendant how to obtain relevant computer files from one another, with varying interpretations. There were no rules out there at all that dealt with e-discovery and distinguished electronic documents from other documents, said Mark Boynton, counsel in Kilpatrick Townsend's Winston-Salem office, who helped push the North Carolina Bar Association to draft the bill. If attorneys act reasonably and cooperatively with each other, the law has the potential to reduce cost. The cost of obtaining computer files can be enormous, often more than $100,000 in a case with total litigation cost of $1 million. Attorneys say e-discovery has grown so expensive because of the sheer number of potentially relevant files that exist in electronic form, far more than typically existed when ink on paper was the primary means of storing information. The burden of producing documents usually falls more heavily on defendants because the issues in question frequently involve internal corporate decisions and leads to questions of who made those decisions. Why, when, and with input from whom? One salient feature of the new rules is that they create guidelines for obtaining metadata, information in a computer file that may not be immediately obvious, such as draft versions of a file, the identity of the authors, and the times the file was created and modified. The rules also require judges to lay out a schedule for the discovery process in cases where one of the litigants requests it. Brian Vick, an attorney with Williams Mullen in Raleigh, says such schedules can make the discovery process quicker and more efficient. State judges haven't always ordered such schedules in the past, Vic says. There's a recognition that the cost with e-discovery, if it's not handled in the right way, can be astronomical, Vic says. 35 states and the District of Columbia have formalized rules on e-discovery, and another 2 states appear likely to do so in the near future, says Thomas Allman, a professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Most have modeled their rules on the federal rules. Boynton and the others who helped develop North Carolina's rules say they differ from the federal rules in that they're likely to trigger fewer fines from businesses that inadvertently fail to preserve electronic data. And that's partly because litigants in state court are frequently less sophisticated than those in federal court. It was perceived that the federal practice was more expensive and involved than we needed it to be, says Raleigh attorney Neil Ryman, a member and former chairman of the North Carolina Bar Association's Technology Advisory Committee. State Representative Deborah Ross, a Raleigh attorney who co-sponsored the bill, says she recently handled a particularly complex discovery process in litigation between 2 large energy companies. Had the new rules been in place, the process would have been simpler, she says. It's not an unknown, she says, of electronic discovery under the new rules. You don't get held up in litigation over, can I get this? Can't I get this? This week's lead article on the front page is entitled Pretend and Extend at an End. Banks look for ways to sell millions in foreclosed properties by Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh, Wells Fargo, SunTrust, and BB&T are at the top among banks in the Triangle, being saddled with bulbous inventories of vacant land and commercial property taken back due to delinquent loans. Three banks at this point hold more than 560 parcels of property gained through foreclosures in Wake and Durham counties, according to a review of county records. They'll probably add more as banks are becoming less willing to extend loan terms or lines of credit. The days of pretend and extend are over, Jeff Benson, a Raleigh real estate lawyer and partner with the Kilpatrick Townsend Law Firm, says of the practice. At the same time, bankers are looking for ways to rid themselves of the properties. For example, Wells Fargo is expected within the next 45 days to begin marketing a portfolio that will include two of its largest Triangle real estate assets, the 1,400-acre undeveloped Wendell Falls community in eastern Wake County, and the 680-acre 12 Oaks Golf Community in Holly Springs. Wells Fargo predecessor company Wachovia Bank invested about $99 million with the original developers of the two communities to finance the purchase of land and the construction of roads and other infrastructure, according to county records. While construction of 12 Oaks was already well underway and operates under a receivership arrangement, no home lots had been sold at Wendell Falls when the real estate market crashed. The bank foreclosed on the property in 2010 and has since reached a revised development agreement with the town of Wendell that will allow it to move forward under new ownership. Under the direction of General Manager Dave Manson of Land Tech Incorporated, 75 homes at 12 Oaks have been sold since January 1. We're now performing at a level that everyone expected we would be at this point, Mason says. We feel like they are poised to be offered now, says Bill Honaker, Mid-Atlantic Regional Manager for Wells Fargo Special Situations Group that handles what's called Other Real Estate Owned, or OREO. OREO holdings can include home mortgage delinquencies, but a large portion of a bank's OREO portfolio is vacant land, residential lots, or other property that was secured by a commercial-type loan or note. Honaker says his team of three people, which manages about $300 million worth of real estate owed by Wells Fargo, has been working for more than a year to resolve issues that could devalue its OREO assets in the Mid-Atlantic. Our strategy is more to create value where there is value to be had, he says. We analyze, put a strategy together, then hopefully put it to market in the best light. SunTrust and BB&T have been assigning properties to third-party broker groups to market to potential buyers. Justin Good, a land specialist with Cassidy Turley Commercial Real Estate Firm in Raleigh, says about 70% of the deals he's marketing are bank-owned properties. Some lenders are more exposed than others, and some have taken a more aggressive sales role, he says. It depends on the bank's balance sheet at the end of the day. Benson, the real estate lawyer, says that while the bank foreclosures have hurt the developers or investors who lost their investment in the properties, the quick disposition of distressed properties is good for the market in the long run. The bank doesn't have any emotional investment, so they're more likely to take an objective look at the property for what it's worth. Warts and all, he says. It gets the property back on the market for what they actually should be bought and sold for. Jim Anderson, president of real estate consulting firm Fuller Land and Development in Raleigh, estimates that Triangle banks have worked through about half of the real estate deals that were most at risk of bank foreclosure and resale. The banks are going to be in the business of foreclosure and repositioning of discount assets for at least another year. Could be 2 years, he says. Following up that article, a companion piece is entitled Foreclosure Load Getting Heavier, Not Lighter, by Lee Weisbecker, also from Raleigh. With the economy idling in neutral, many Triangle banks are revving the engine but going in the wrong direction by continuing to add a variety of foreclosed property onto their books. As of June 30th, the volume of foreclosed properties, dubbed Other Real Estate Owned, or OREO, being carried by a dozen area community banks was valued at $109 million, 4% higher than 6 quarters prior in March 2010. The surge was even more pronounced at two Raleigh-based regional lenders, for Citizens Bank and RBC Bank USA, which is being acquired by PNC Bank. Collectively, OREO rose to $404 million at the pair as of June 30th, up 29% over March 2010. The property seized, used as collateral for loans that subsequently went delinquent, includes home mortgages, plots of land once earmarked for construction, and commercial buildings. As for some very large banks with a prominent triangle market share, total foreclosures actually declined at Winston-Salem-based BB&T and Atlanta-based SunTrust by 15% and 12% respectively. The BB&T decline was due in part to a 37% drop in the number of residential mortgage foreclosures over the past six quarters and a 26% decline since December. Those banks' experiences mirrored a 25% drop in home foreclosures nationwide during the first 6 months of 2011, according to Tyler White of Urban California-based RealtyTrack. White attributes the decline in large part to procedural delays in working new foreclosure cases through the system. San Francisco-based Wells Fargo experienced an even larger drop in home foreclosures, 43%, during the first 6 months of the year. But even with that let-up, the bank's overall volume of OREO still rose by 25% in the six quarters from March 2010 to June 2011. The larger banks don't readily break down their quarterly OREO numbers by geographic area. Matthew Jones, who follows trends in real estate lending by North Carolina and regional banks for Charlotte-based Forum Realty Capital, says he expects to see the OREO numbers continue to rise. Statewide, though, the first quarter of 2011, the value of OREO on the books of all North Carolina banks had risen by 8.8% over the same period in 2011, says Jones, who has not yet crunched the numbers for second quarter 2011. Bank managers might write down the value of some of the land and other real properties they've seized for non-repayment and or sell the property, he explains. That can lead to ups and downs in the OREO figures the lenders post from quarter to quarter. But they will also continue adding new properties to the pile, says Jones, who adds that the key to a real turnaround in real estate is an improved economy. These numbers will only start dropping when you start seeing a pickup in employment and consumer spending. Former banking regulator Don Coker says OREO on a lender's books generates no return. Beyond that, the properties are a drag on banks, which must pay insurance, taxes, and maintenance fees on the property. Those fees continue until the property is sold. In the case of residential and commercial property, he adds, bankers take current real estate market conditions into account as they project the true value of their OREO 3 to 5 years down the line before arriving at a net present value, which more often than not is a discounted figure. If you are making no return on an investment of, let's say, $150,000, and you chop it to $120,000 and sell it, at least you now have money that can be lent out again. It's money you can do something with, he says. Now inside, past the front cover, with Keystone Buy, summer sales hit $410 million. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Durham. A Texas real estate investment group has paid $88.8 million for 11 single-story office buildings in Keystone Technology Park in Durham to close out the hottest summer season for real estate deals in 3 years. Since June 1, more than $410 million worth of apartment buildings, retail centers, warehouses, and office properties in the Triangle have traded hands among local, regional, and national investors. Another $20 million worth of investment properties are still on the market with sales pending, sources say. It's a good time to sell, says Stephen Porterfield of Capital Associates in Cary, an asset manager for the Keystone Technology Park properties that were sold to the Lionstone Group of Houston, Texas. I was very pleased at how the capital markets responded to the property, and it just goes to show there is still capital chasing stable, well-leased properties in our market. The 11 Keystone buildings purchased by Lionstone were 94% occupied in the second quarter, according to Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey. Lionstone purchased all but one building in the Durham Park, the 82,000-square-foot laboratory building that Wyeth Pharmaceuticals vacated in December after that company was acquired by Pfizer. Porterfield says Capital Associates and its partner in the property, Guggenheim Partners of Chicago, will continue to seek a tenant for the building. Guggenheim and Capital Associates paid $100 million for the 12 buildings in 2006, the largest sales transaction that year. But one other deal this year tops the Lionstone purchase. Inland American Real Estate Trust paid $95 million for the White Oak Crossing Retail Center in Garner earlier in August. The properties we have had the opportunity to market, we've had a lot of good, strong offers, a lot of tours, and a lot of interest, says David Finger, managing principal of the Raleigh office of the Cassidy Turley Commercial Real Estate Firm. We are having people fly in to see these. They are not doing it from their desks. They are coming here and learning about the market and learning about the property. Cassidy Turley also is marketing for sale the three Keystone Park office buildings at 430 Davis Drive, 530 Davis Drive, and 630 Davis Drive on behalf of the owners that paid $45 million for them in 2007. Collectively, these buildings have less than 5% vacancy. A total of $958 million worth of Triangle investment properties were sold in 2010. That was more than double the $408 million in properties sold to investors in 2009, according to a C.B. Richard Ellis survey. Hoping to capitalize on the momentum of the market, Duke Realty Corporation is offering for sale six of its office buildings in the Triangle, or about 10% of its Triangle office portfolio. The portfolio is expected to fetch more than $50 million. Duke Realty is the presumed suitor for the Greenfield North Industrial Park in Garner that's been on the market since March. Finger would not comment about a pending deal for Greenfield North, but the company's website indicates the property is under contract for sale. Jeff Sheehan, Senior Vice President of Duke Realty's Raleigh office, says Indianapolis-based Duke Realty has been trying to reduce its exposure to the office markets and focus more on its industrial properties, medical office buildings, opportunities. That's been Duke's strategy the past 2 years, Sheehan says. I can't announce anything yet, but we should be announcing a few industrial acquisitions in the very near future. Next up, Duke sets $71 million remake for Unit by Jason DeBrun from Durham. The Duke University Ice Center is bursting at the seams and will undergo a $71 million expansion that will create new jobs in Durham. The facility was built to accommodate about 20,000 patient visits a year, but is currently seeing about 60,000 annually, says Duncan Yagi, Duke University Health System Chief Planning Officer. The main driver for the expansion is the pressure on the existing facility, Yagi says. Construction costs include $26 million for materials, $17 million for labor, $6 million for architect and engineering fees, and $7 million for equipment, according to project plans. Duke targets project completion for early 2016, but Yagi says that could change depending on construction costs and financing options. Financial information was contained in Duke's expansion application filed with state regulators. Duke data reveal the Eye Center is a profit maker for the Duke health care system. In 2010, Duke Health earned $316 million in profit from continuing operations. That represented a 15% profit margin on total operating revenue of $2.1 billion. And for the Eye Care Center, that same year, Duke earned $8.8 million of net income on $31.4 million of net revenue, good enough for a 28% margin. Due to startup costs, the Eye Center's net income will drop below $3 million in the first years of operation, but Duke's project revenue will increase steadily, climbing to $43.8 million on 2018. On the staffing end, the Eye Center will add 32.13 full-time equivalent positions. The center will not add any operating rooms, of which it currently has five. The Duke Eye Center performs specialized procedures including neuro-ophthalmology for visual problems related to the nervous system and oculoplastics, which deals with tumors on or around the eye. UNC Hospital performs many similar procedures at the Kittner Eye Center and other practices, including NC Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat, and Raleigh Neurology compete in those same areas as well, says Dr. Saidi Giver, neuro-ophthalmologist at Raleigh Neurology. As with nearly all expanding medical facilities, aging baby boomers played a role in the decision to expand. Patients younger than 65 years old average 1.7 visits per year, Yagi says. Patients older than 65 years average 2.7 visits per year. To make space, Duke has rearranged certain aspects of the existing center, but there is only so much square footage. The fact is, we really are constrained, Yagi says. Duke projects the population of residents 65 and older in its coverage area to increase by 31.4% from 2010 to 2015. By comparison, the 45 to 64 age group will increase by 15.4%, and those in the 18 to 44 group will increase by 3.2%. Certainly, conventional wisdom is that older people require more health care, but that is especially true in areas of orthopedics, cardiology, and eye care, says CEO Richard C. Edlow with the Katzen Eye Group in Maryland. About 2% of the population under 65 years utilize an eye care facility in a year, he says, compared to as much as 12% or more of the population older than 65. Diseases such as cataracts, for example, will develop in every human being who lives long enough. From that perspective, with enough birthdays, it is what it is, Edlow says. You can't escape it. Diseases like glaucoma and macular degeneration will not affect everyone, but are more prevalent in the older population, he says. Next up, building a sector. Microbreweries emerging as a legitimate industry with jobs, by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. If Triangle microbreweries are making your head spin, it may be because of their proliferation and their variety of specialty beers, and not that you've quaffed too many. Microbrewing has grown explosively in the 6 years since a change in state law allowed higher alcohol content, expanding by about 58% in the last year alone to an $8.5 million industry that has given rise to niche pubs and helped to support a handful of small farms. Two breweries started up last year and another this spring, bringing the number of local breweries to at least 11. Their 100-plus brews range from light-colored, mild beers such as Pilsners and Coalesces to tangy India Pale Ales and a few porters, ales that are dark and moderately heavy with roasted malts. Local brewers say the Triangle and other cities with lively microbrewing scenes, such as San Diego, Seattle, and Boston, share demographics such as relatively high incomes and levels of education. Several local brewery owners start out brewing on the weekends in their basements while working Monday through Friday in information technology or other science-related fields. People here just don't talk about local beers, says Sumit Volhal, CEO of Lone Rider Brewery in Raleigh. They become evangelists. Foha and two colleagues from Cisco Systems Local Operations in Research Triangle Park launched Lone Rider in January 2009. It brewed 3,700 barrels last year, enough for more than 900,000 pint servings, and is on track to double this year, says Foha, who quit Cisco and now runs Lone Rider full-time. Small craft breweries such as Lone Rider accounted for 4.9% of U.S. beer sales in 2010, up from about 4% in 2008, according to the Brewers Association, a trade group. Craft beer sales have been growing at a 10% clip in recent years, even last year when the overall beer market shrank. Triangle microbreweries are on track to put out about 34,000 barrels this year, representing growth of about 58% from 21,500 barrels last year, based on interviews with brewers. Brewers credit their faster growth rate locally to changes in state law. In 2005, that raised the cap on alcohol content to 15% from 6%. That increase has freed them to use a wider variety of brewing styles that depend on larger quantities or varieties of malted wheat or barley, and therefore produce more alcohol during fermentation. Daniel Bradford, who publishes the magazine All About Beer from Durham, says he believes North Carolina brewers are leading an entire quarter of the country out from under the dominance of mild, light-colored lagers. This is a very young industry in the South, Bradford says. There's pretty much a wide-open market. Based on $130 average wholesale price of a half-barrel keg, Triangle's production of 34,000 barrels translates into about $8.5 million annually, That's hardly in the same league with local industries such as software or healthcare, but it spills over into bars and restaurants that lure guests with unique brews and then sell $10 cheeseburgers and more. Bars' margins on craft beers are also larger than on mass-distributed beers. A half dozen or so venues in the Triangle serve only North Carolina brews, including Beasley's Chicken and Honey, which recently opened in downtown Raleigh. Porter City's Tavern in Raleigh, where entrees range from $13 to $26, made the switch early last year. We made the jump when we realized that there were not only a substantial number of local craft breweries, but that they were very high in quality, says Chris Fillon, assistant manager of Porter's. Switching over to in-state brews improved our business big time. Customers appreciate both the beer and the effort to help other local businesses, Fillon says. Similar to the locavore movement among restaurants, some microbrewers are increasing their use of locally grown ingredients. At Full Steam Brewery in Durham, CEO Sean Lilly Wilson has used sweet potatoes, scuppernong grapes, persimmons, pears, figs, and hominy in various beers. We're trying to push the envelope, she says. Next up, Patterson, new team takeover at Capstone. Ogburn out. By Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh. 5-year-old Capstone Bank is embracing management and strategic changes as it begins to move away from a single-location, business-focused banking model. And charting the altered course is a new lineup at the top. Longtime banker and Capstone founder Michael Patterson has stepped into the role of chairman, president, and CEO following the departure of Chief Executive Steve Ogburn. Chief Credit Officer Robert Branch, who joined the bank about 4 years ago, has moved to the position of Chief Banking Officer, and Debbie Lee, a Patterson associate when both worked at then Triangle Bank, has come on board full-time as CFO. Ogburn, Capstone CEO since the bank opened in 2006, left the post about a month ago. Capstone did not make a public announcement of the transition. Attempts to reach Ogburn were not successful. It was an amicable departure, says Patterson. He did a great job while he was here, but we decided to make the change. We've been together in the banking business for 40 years, and I have nothing but best wishes from him and his family. Patterson says Branch, Lee, and others will focus on day-to-day operations and customer contacts while he focuses on strategic direction. Part of what he will be thinking about, Patterson says, will be creating retail branch offices as Capstone departs from its original model of catering to business customers. He says he'll push to complete a branch in Cary and hopes to make it profitable in 18 to 24 months. After that, we could open 3 to 4 more offices over the next 6 to 8 years, he says, adding that growth by acquisitions could be in the cards. The new offices will give the bank more diversity in both the customers and the deposits it draws. It's a fundamental shift away from the business bank model, under which, in its basic form, a lender would operate out of a single location to hold down costs. Instead of relying on retail customers to make deposits to fuel lending, the business banker would buy deposits from money brokers and other sources. In retrospect, says Patterson, it was too easy, and banks based on the model have shown themselves not only overexposed in their real estate lending portfolio, but also vulnerable to liquidity problems. And that is not where we want to be, he says. With $202 million in total assets and 24 employees as of June 30, 2011, Capstone was posting profits 16 months after opening its doors in August 2006, and has continued to post positive numbers since, despite the troubles battering the industry. It remains well capitalized under regulatory guidelines. As a lifetime banker and engineer of banking startups, Patterson has the capabilities to set Capstone on its new course, says local industry observers. He is a savvy banker, says Raleigh attorney Tony Guetta, whose office represents roughly a third of North Carolina banks and which has worked with Capstone in the past. On the Patterson resume are high-level, if not top, executive stints at the one-time banking entities People's Bank, Triangle Bank, and Centura Bank. Patterson was chairman of the board at Centura when it was purchased by Royal Bank of Canada in 2001. After that merger, Patterson left to start Capstone, recruiting Ogburn as CEO. Mike has been successful at everything he's done, says Raleigh banker Scott Custer, who worked with Patterson when then Centura Bank acquired Triangle Bank. He is a solid banker and a good leader, and I'd put my money on him. Next up, No Leader for Blackstone as Geographical Issue Debated by Monica Chin. From Durham, 2 months after a self-imposed deadline, organizers of an effort to connect universities with entrepreneurs has yet to bring on board an executive director. A committee had expected to have an executive director for the Blackstone Entrepreneurs Network by June. With the help of search firm Heidrick and Struggles, they have interviewed 6 candidates and are now down to finalists. A decision is expected in several weeks. The search took longer than anticipated at first, says Kimberly Jenkins, senior advisor to the president and provost for innovation and entrepreneurship at Duke University. But I think that's because the June deadline was more reflective of our aspirations than reality. Besides Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State University, NC Central University, and the CED are involved in the initiative. A key issue in finding a leader that has been whether the committee should go with an executive director from outside the triangle who could tap into his or her networks in Silicon Valley and Boston, or someone local who has the knowledge of the universities and companies in the area. The ambitious program seeks to mentor 150 startup teams over 5 years with the potential to create 17,000 jobs. To do so, it will have 3 master entrepreneurs at each university and CED to meet with students and startups. The master entrepreneurs will be coordinated by an executive director who will be the face of the initiative on the national stage. The network has been seeded with $3.63 million from the Blackstone Charitable Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the financial services giant Blackstone Group. The commitment we've all made is that we want the best spin-outs to come out of the universities, and if they predominantly come out of one or two, so be it, says Jenkins. This will be a community of mentors who will be looking for the best ideas. Among key decisions being delayed until a leader is in place is who the master entrepreneurs will be and whether they will be able to choose their universities or be assigned. The committee has reached out to reviewed applications from 60 entrepreneurs interested in becoming mentors. Some are waiting to see who the executive director will be before agreeing to participate. The mentors will be asked to put 1/4 of their time in the initiative. They will be paid stipends of $30,000 each. Although the committee has not disclosed the names of master entrepreneurs, some Triangle business owners have publicly expressed interest, including Ping Fu, CEO of 3D software company Geomagic Incorporated. The committee is already getting requests from startups to mentorship. We've been trying to explain on our website that it's way too early to accept clients. We're not the ones to be making this decision, says Judith Cohn, special assistant to UNC Chancellor Holden Thorpe. Committee members are expecting to grow the cross-regional ties. I think the creation of a denser network is a direct impact of the initiative, says Malkavia Sudharjan, an assistant professor of business at NCCU. Right now, it's very sparse and far from one another. There are little cliques. And now it's time for A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. This article is entitled, Reaching Out to Durham's Kids in Need. This summer, roughly 60 third, fourth, and fifth graders from Y.E. Smith Elementary School, one of Durham's lowest performing schools, attended a 6-week camp designed to keep them from losing academic ground they gained last year in school. Staffing the camp, which featured tutoring in the morning and traditional camp activities in the afternoon, were students from Duke University and NC Central University trained last spring by the Hill Center. The program is part of a growing array of community-based services coordinated by the East Durham Children's Initiative, which manages a collaboration of roughly 35 partner agencies working to support families and children in a 120-block area east of downtown Durham. We make the promise that we'll start from the cradle and get kids ready for college or ready for a career, says David Reese, director of the initiative, which is housed at the Center for Child and Family Health, a consortium operated by Duke, NC Central, and UNC Chapel Hill. Reese says the effort, modeled on the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, aims to address the interconnected social problems that contribute to poverty, all of which are rooted in education and depend on engaging the community to fix them. Serving as the attendance zone for Y.E. Smith Elementary School, the East Durham neighborhood that is the focus of the initiative is characterized by all the social ills, Reese says. This is about changing outcomes for a community, he says. The heart of it is in the school. Programs launched so far by the initiative, which operates with an annual budget of roughly $1 million, include a nurse from Durham Connects, a nurse home visiting service of the Center for Child and Family Policy at Duke, identifies every child born in the 120 block area, assesses family needs, and refers at-risk families to Healthy Families Durham, a home-based case management program at the Center for Child and Family Health at Duke. A curriculum known as Incredible Years, provided through Healthy Families Durham, teaches parenting and teaching skills to parents. The Hill Center this year will train child care facilities in the neighborhood to administer a literacy program 15 minutes a day to 3- and 4-year-old children in their care. Tutors from YMCA work every day from 3:20 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. with students at Y.E. Smith Elementary, where the school day has been extended. Citizen Schools this school year will launch a tutoring program at Neal Middle School, where Teach for America is also adding 15 teachers. The initiative is hiring new staff to serve as advocates in the schools for families and children, and teaching parents to be advocates in the schools for their kids. Reese says a core initial goal is to help parents of young children better prepare themselves and their kids for kindergarten. He also says new projects will be added as the initiative identifies new opportunities for high-quality, evidence-based interventions and new partners. This is about moving the needle, he says, one step at a time. When the United Way kicks off its campaign this year, it wants to make it a glowing affair. The United Way of the Greater Triangle will try to set a Guinness World Record at its campaign kickoff on September 8th. Everyone who attends will receive a glow stick. If at least 309 show up, that group will officially break the record for largest glow stick design. The event will be at 8:30 a.m. September 8th in the Holzhauser Building at the State Fairgrounds in Raleigh. Continuing on, Triangle Counties Target Tourists Who Love Farms and Arts, by Monica Chin, from Durham. Visitors bureaus in the Triangle are partnering to lure two diverse groups of vacationers, those interested in agriculture and those who love the arts. The Agritourism Initiative, led by Durham Convention and Visitors Bureau, plans to launch a website in late fall to promote local farms, markets, wineries, and restaurants that use local ingredients. The Arts Tourism Initiative, led by the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, has launched a website that's a portal to arts offerings in different counties. The two initiatives, which target day trippers, are the first regional initiatives targeting specific market segments and not undertaken through the State Tourism Office. The ideas were first pitched and discussed a year ago. A regional promotion made sense in these two areas, says DCVB President Shelley Green. Arts people will travel further distances to see art. Someone that's here to visit the Nasher Museum of Art would find it very appealing to go to the North Carolina Museum of Art and the Akron Art Museum. Most people don't travel that way. They don't travel for a thing to do, they travel for a destination. It's the same with agritourism, she says. This region is so rich in those resources that we thought this would be fitting with an ongoing strategy for foodies in Durham, as well as find an opportunity to appeal to day trippers. The Bull City has experienced increased interest from culinary aficionados, or foodies, in recent years. In 2010, according to the DCVB, 46% of day visitors to Durham participated in dining, and 17% said that was the main reason for their trip. That's up from 41% participating in dining in 2003, with 14% saying that was the main reason. There were 6.3 million visitors to Durham in 2009, the most recent year for which statistics are available. Farms in the area are also stepping up visitor offerings to supplement their income. Elodie Farms in Rougemont, north of Durham, opened in 2001, and at first focused on its main product, goat cheese. It now has 30 goats. In 2006, the farm started the Dinner on the Porch series, which charges $65 per person for a gourmet meal cooked by notable chefs in the Triangle. The event has featured Amy Turnquist of Watts Grocery in Durham and Scott Crawford of the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary. The dinner for August sold out within an hour and a half. Owner Dave Artigues says 30 to 40% of his farm's revenue now comes through agritourism. You're not going to make it selling goat cheese unless you're a huge farm, and I didn't want to be a huge farm, he says. I saw a serious potential, a demand that would help me grow the business with other revenue streams. The farm, which offers tours for school children to see its goats, also started a summer camp program this year. Orange County counts 19 farms and farmers markets on its CVB website. The Pittsboro-Siler City CVB lists 48 agritourism destinations in Chatham County alone. Durham and Wake's CVBs do not keep track of agritourism sites. Durham's CVB is providing the bulk of the marketing work, including setting up of the marketing work, including setting up the website and compiling a directory that will include information from the four counties. The Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau soft launched an arts tourism website in July that's a portal to other visitor websites. Chatham County isn't involved in the arts initiative. Raleigh welcomed an addition to its art scene this spring with the opening of the Contemporary Art Museum in the Warehouse District. Of 5.6 million stays in 2010, 6 to 8% said they were interested in visiting in visual and performing arts activities. We felt like the different counties marketed our destination separately to visitors, particularly day trippers, says Jonathan Fries, GRCVB marketing director. For overnight visitors, I'd hate for them to come to one destination and miss the others that are close by. For those really passionate about art, that's what we would want to encourage, for them to see all three counties. The following article is entitled New Federal Regs Change Playing Field for Human Research by Jason DeBrun from Durham. The federal government has proposed changes to rules that govern what researchers may do with the personal and biological data of individuals. The new regulations update rules governing human research subjects and could make it easier for researchers to do widespread blind studies, but it also means that data might be used years after the time it is collected and without the knowledge of the person from whom it was collected. To be sure, any biological data used will have been de-identified, and the majority of rules change apply to survey research only, not pharmaceutical or medical procedures. By and large, the rules governing research are simply outdated, say supporters of the rule changes. It's time to bring the regulations that govern human research up to 21st century to better reflect the types of research being conducted today, says Heather Pierce, Director of Science Policy and Regulatory Counsel for the Association of American Medical Colleges. The changes would apply to research done with the support of federal money. Private research would not necessarily be impacted. However, any new research used for new drug application or new medical procedure must comply with the FDA, which has similar rules. In 1981, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services expanded its protections of human research subjects, largely in response to a scandal surrounding what was known as the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. Since 1991, those regulations have seen almost no changes, yet research with humans has substantially increased in volume, with more international and multi-site studies, more health services research, and more research with biospecimens, according to Dr. Ezekiel J. Emanuel and Dr. Jerry Menikoff, who authored a research study titled Reforming the Regulations Governing Research with Human Subjects, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. The most significant changes might end up having nothing to do with the research itself, but with what is called informational risk, or what happens with data gathering from human subjects. Institutional revenue boards, made up of scientists, doctors, and other experts, vet every research project. Over the years, IRBs have started making more rules on information privacy instead of research safety and efficiency. In fact, the first two issues raised by the DHHS deal was the use of information. These changes would establish specified data security protections for all studies, but allow researchers to obtain open-ended permission to use biospecimens collected. In the HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act era, there have been lots of complaints that, in effect, IRBs have become very risk-averse, especially about information privacy issues, says Doug Petticord, Executive Director of ACRO, the Association of Contract Research Organizations. As a result, he says, academic and, to a lesser extent, commercial research has been negatively affected. Research has just gotten harder to do. The rules changes would allow researchers to tackle broad-based subjects, he says. For example, biospecimens collected from every newborn would open up a broader base of research subjects without the time-consuming and costly process of gathering new data. For commercial researchers such as Quintiles, one change in particular could mean cost savings. Currently, research done at multiple sites requires approval from each site's IRB, which makes for most things not to be efficient, says Judith Beach, Quintiles Senior Associate General Counsel for Regulatory and Government Affairs and Chief Privacy Officer. One proposed rule change would allow one IRB to make decisions for all sites of one study, and Beach says that would be a lot more efficient. This week's guest column is from Stephen Ferguson. Stephen L. Ferguson is the chairman of the board of directors for Cook Group, Incorporated of Bloomington, Indiana. Medical equipment tax, a burden. While we support recent national efforts to increase access to medical care, reduce spending, and enhance the quality of American health care, a new tax cloaked in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act will do far more harm than good. A 2.3% federal tax on medical device company revenues will harm an important economic sector when it goes into effect in 2013. Cook Medical of Bloomington, Indiana, established Cook Endoscopy in Winston-Salem in 1983. Cook Endoscopy opened with 35 jobs. Today, 500 people manufacture or market an array of devices, including hemostasis clips, a treatment to stop bleeding from stomach ulcers and wounds called hemospray, echo-tip ultrasound needles, and dozens of other minimally invasive devices. All novel medical devices come about as the result of years of painstaking research and development. But with this tax, research and development will be the first place companies cut. That, in turn, will slow the search for cures for cancer, diabetes, and peripheral artery disease, and patient suffering will be prolonged. We believe the tax will freeze job creation, too, as companies shift work to low-wage countries in order to pay for a 43% tax, one-year increase in federal taxes. That exodus is already underway. For example, Covidien, C.R. Bard, and Boston Scientific recently announced 1,800 jobs will be lost to nations such as Costa Rica, China, and Mexico. Boston Scientific projects an earnings hit of $100 plus million. Zimmer expects to lay off 450 and is girding for a new tax bill of $50 million. Cook Medical expects our federal taxes to explode by $23 million. Thus, we have shelved plans to build a new factory annually in the U.S. Proponents contend the Affordable Care Act will lead to millions of new patients, but patients who are ill enough to receive a medical device already get it today in emergency rooms, whether they have insurance or not. When Massachusetts revised its health care system, device companies saw no flood of new patients. A 2.3% top-line tax impacts earnings by 15%. For some companies, it could be 100% of profit. Tack on an existing 35% federal corporate tax and state taxes of 5%, and American medical device companies end up with a 55% tax rate. Imagine paying a 55% tax rate on every dollar earned. You couldn't make it. Certainly, something has to be done to bring health care to millions of uninsured Americans, but singling out one industry should be the last tactic tried, not the first. If new revenues are needed, why not tariffs on companies based in Zurich that manufacture in India and dump catheters on patients in North Carolina? Why not a tax on automobiles, since much trauma and many emergency room visits stem from highway accidents? If new revenues are absolutely necessary, there are dozens of why nots that offer a fairer approach than a tax that discriminates against our nation's most innovative industry. So far, 187 members of Congress have co-sponsored a repeal, H.R. 436. They recognize that patients will pay the highest price with treatments that were not discovered, cures that were never found. We believe the implications of this tax were not truly understood by lawmakers at the time it was passed, and continue to hope more lawmakers will revisit this legislation to see how it will harm patients. At this time, Congress needs to put politics on a shelf and repeal this tax. Here's a Holmes conundrum. The federal government wants ideas from the private sector about what to do with an estimated 92,000 foreclosed homes owned by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Administration. The Federal Housing Finance Agency issued a request for information on new options for disposing of these homes, including pooling these properties and turning them into rental housing. The goal is to reduce the number of government-owned homes while getting back as much money for taxpayers as possible. For the fifth year, Project Connect will be staged in Chapel Hill. It's a one-day, one-stop center to provide people experiencing or at risk of experiencing homelessness with a broad range of services, including housing, employment, health and dental care, mental health care, veterans and social service benefits, legal services, and the like. This year's event will be from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on October 13th at the Hargraves Community Center. Occam, a clinical research organization in Durham, has donated computers, keyboards, and monitors to the Durham Nativity School, which serves middle school boys who come from financially challenged families. It offers a tuition-free, enhanced learning atmosphere. People across the Triangle had their early afternoon's activities shaken up by tremors created by a 5.8 magnitude earthquake near Richmond, Virginia on Tuesday. It's the strongest earthquake along the East Coast since 1944. No one here believed it. We thought workers were on the roof or somebody was cutting down trees on the property, says Patrick O'Neill. Of course, half the building missed it because they were focused on work. Twitter news breaks verified it for us immediately. We've run out of time for today's episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The web address for this episode is at triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long, until next time.